welcome to Terra Nullius Cyprus. I'm Costa Constanti. You're listening to us through the Island Talks channel that's hosting us. I want to thank our sponsors, CVAR Servetus Foundation in the Old Town of Nicosia. We're recording from their Seridis Library, which is a beautiful venue, and Limoncello for their delicious food and drinks. They're based at Ayos Andonis Market in Nicosia. Today, I have a guest. His name is George Giordano. I want to thank you, George, for joining me today.
Thank you for inviting me.
It's been a bit of a while since we last talked in person. It's been some time, but we've talked electronically. I follow you on social media. I've brought you in today because as a fellow father, as a fellow man, as a fellow Cypriot, what you write and what you share with the world resonates with me. Your stories about fatherhood, your experiences, your commentary, your analysis. It's one of those cases where I always want to write. I couldn't have said it better myself. I'm going to start right from the start. Let's just take a couple steps back. You're Nicosia born, are you?
Yeah, Aglanja.
Aglanja, so you're a Nicosia born and bred?
Yeah.
Did you go to private or public school?
Public school for primary school, private for secondary.
Okay, so you've experienced both realms?
Yes.
Okay. And and you work professionally, and I know that you're involved in a lot of different... I won't call it NGOs, but you work with a very important humanitarian kind of things. But with your writings as parents, you're a father of two.
Yes.
How old are they?
Six and two.
So the easy years. Because according to all of my friends that have kids that are teenagers and older, they reckon that these are the easy years. So
that's scary.
That's scary. But tell me, how did this start? Tell me, what made you start writing and sharing with the world?
So, I never aspired to become a father, right?
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, it seemed like a good idea.
Okay.
So, we decided to give it a try.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife gave birth to our firstborn boy, Ioannis, And suddenly I found myself in shock that nobody prepared us for the experience.
Right.
Right. Yeah. So everything was described with a positive spin beforehand, which contradicted the experience right after the birth, which is quite challenging.
Again, you don't know what you're doing. It resonates with me.
And also during that rather difficult initial period, you had people around us, like in the social circle, with expectations of how we should be feeling for being new parents.
And how you should raise them and how you should do it.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Let me pull out that comment, the expectations on how you should feel.
Yes.
Like everyone says, it's going to be the greatest experience of your life. You're going to be so happy. You're going to look at the world so differently. You certainly look at the world very differently. But this elation and joy, like, don't get me wrong, we love our kids. We absolutely love them. But it's tiring.
But if I'm sleepless for a year, I'm not going to be all
cheerful.
You're shattered.
You're destroyed. Your life is turned upside down. And as much as you love them, that moment when they're crying and screaming and you're changing a nappy, it's not fun. There's nothing fun about that.
Yeah.
There's nothing fun about that.
Sorry.
No one prepares you for this.
Yeah. And I was shocked, actually, that no one did.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay. I process thoughts in writing, right?
Yeah.
Since I was a kid.
Yeah.
So I started writing a couple of blog posts. I have a blog since I was 15. And people started reacting to it positively, interestingly, primarily through private comments.
Yes.
Which I found very, very interesting because I wasn't saying anything controversial.
No, depends.
But it appears that certain statements were, in fact, taboo.
I mean, telling the world that you're tired and it wasn't the most fun moment of your life, people think that's controversial. You should love everything about your children.
Yes.
They poop their nappies. This is amazing. No, it's not.
At the same time, I was looking, the algorithm picked up to the fact that I was a new parent.
Yeah.
And on social media, you get those perfect portrayals of parenthood.
Yes.
I'm like, my life is not like that.
No.
My life is not, I'm struggling yeah. to keep them alive. Yeah. That's my standard for the first year.
That's the basic demand.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
So I started writing, and eventually I saw it as a way to document the different milestones of them growing up.
Sorry to interrupt. Did it make you feel comfortable, or did it validate you when you just said that you're trying to keep them alive? When other people comment to you that they agree with you, that, or they feel that they're experiencing the same thing, did it make you think, I'm not crazy, it's not me, I'm not a bad parent, this is what actually is normal?
I never thought I was a bad parent or something. Mm-hmm. I realized that this is
the reality.
This Good. Is the experience of humankind mm-hmm. Throughout the dawns of time.
Yeah.
But I found it interesting that mm-hmm. others reached out
yep.
and wanted to go for coffee and discuss things and give them a bit of space to vent.
Mainly men?
Mainly men, but not only men.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So, eventually it became also a diary in the sense that I wanted to document the different milestones mm-hmm. and the loss associated with each milestone. Let me give you an example.
Yep.
We alternate on who puts each kid to bed every mm-hmm. couple of nights. And when the second one, my daughter Despina, I was putting her to bed, she was sleeping on my chest. Mm-hmm. She wouldn't sleep unless she would climb on my chest.
Yeah.
Listen to my heart rate, relax, and sleep, and then I would leave her there and go do the rest of the things that you do in the evening. The day that she no longer wanted to climb on my chest was devastating.
It's like losing a limb.
Yes, but it's also a milestone mm-hmm. of development for her.
Yeah.
So I had to process this feeling.
Her gain was your loss.
Her gain, in the sense that she's growing up and she's developing, was something that made me happy.
Yeah.
But losing that experience, I needed to mourn, to process that change. And parenthood is all about change.
Mm-hmm.
Change in relations within the couple, with friendships, and I was mm-hmm. shocked to experience that.
Yeah.
Some friendships grew much, much stronger. Some others did not really make the cut.
Yeah.
And the kids change all the time. So
you'll find that, and as the kids get older as well, it also affects, like, just by the mere fact of having kids changes your relationships. But then what stage of life your kids are at also changes the friends you keep. If that makes sense. Yeah. So like friends that have kids the same age, for example, so they can have a play date, for example. Like if you have a 6-year-old going out with someone that has a 15-year-old, the kids aren't going to play.
Yeah.
Yeah, so this also kind of, our kids kind of dictate at the circles that we frequent, you know.
Keeping the diaries was also a way for me to allow my friends a glimpse into our lives, because we are the first among our network, let's say, mm-hmm. to have kids. Now most of them do, so it's fine, and we go to child appropriate places and so on. But they didn't know what we were experiencing, positive and negative.
Mm-hmm.
So the diary was a good opportunity for them to find out.
Did you find that other than friendship circles changing with the kids coming along, did you find also how you engaged with Cyprus and the public realm changed? For example, before you have kids, you want to go down to the corner store, you want to go to the mall, you want to go to a cafe, there's no thinking needed, you just go. With children, there's planning needed. There's event management needed. There is a... you need to carry things with you.
Yes.
You need to be planning and prepared, and there's a strategy involved. Also, there's places that you can no longer go to because you can't take it. I mean, you can't take a kid into a bar or a nightclub.
Yeah.
You could take them into a cafe, but then, you know, is there a baby chair? Is there a place that's non-smoking? Is it? I mean, what I found was Cyprus meets one need and doesn't meet another. Now, one need that it meets is if I go to a restaurant with kids, kids are welcome. Yeah. I find that overseas, if you have a kid and you walk into a restaurant, people tend to turn their noses up at you because, oh no, the kids are here. In Cyprus, kids are part of the environment in a restaurant. Even if it's a non-family restaurant, kids seem to be accepted. However, kids are not adapted. No one adapts to the kids' needs. So you don't find a playground in a restaurant. You won't find many child chairs. I have three daughters. At one stage, I needed three child chairs. Most restaurants had one, maybe two. And this was just one family with three kids. When we went with other families that had kids, we were finding ourselves holding kids on our laps. Yeah. Or choosing one of five restaurants that actually had kid-friendly facilities. So in one way, they tolerate kids in a restaurant or in a cinema or in a mall. And on the other hand, they don't. The other thing, you put kids in a pram. Now, I had twins. I had a double pram. Footpaths are full of cars. The roads are full of potholes. There's very few pedestrianized areas where you can push a pram. So again, you were limited with your mobility where you could go and explore. I'm not talking about going mountain climbing now, but I wanted to take them for a walk in the old town. I wanted to take them for a walk down Macario. I wanted to go to the Finigudes. And once you're on Finigudes, for example, you could go up and down, but getting from the car to there was impossible. So again, our movements were limited. So we found ourselves, the pandemic didn't help, but we found ourselves stuck at home a lot or going to the same places over and over, which again changes your social circles because you can't meet the same friends at the same place every day.
Yeah, certainly. You know, we've experienced exactly the same from the moment my wife got pregnant. Mm-hmm. We were going to places where people were smoking inside, and you realize that, okay, suddenly this place is not
applicable to me.
And then we needed to select a pram. And we chose one that was called Urban Stroller, something like that.
Yeah, no, I know which one you're talking about.
And what they mean, urban, in more developed countries, differs substantially. So essentially, we couldn't push it down the average street in Cyprus. Of course, the places you go are limited, and but people accommodated us.
Look, I have to admit, the Cypriot people are accommodating. When you turn up with children, especially three in hand, they are adaptive. They are. I've sat in restaurants where the staff have sat down next to us and helped us feed the kids. Okay. I mean, this is beautiful. And I don't see this in many places around the world. I saw it in Greece once. We're in Skiathos, and the lady, I'll never forget, the restaurant was empty. We sat down, and the waitress, well, she may have been the owner, I'm not sure. She sat down and said, "You guys enjoy your meal. I'm going to feed your kid."
Okay.
And it was the best hour of our visit to Skiathos because we had a date lunch. We managed to have a lunch and talk to each other. Well, my oldest daughter was sat and fed by this absolute stranger who was just lovely enough to offer us this help. And this happens in Cyprus quite a lot. Many places we've been to, like when we agro-touristic vacation rooms in the mountains, you know, when we give them notice, we're telling them that we're coming with kids, they'll have cribs set up, they'll have baby beds set up. They often leave toys behind for the kids to play. And I think that family bonding that we have in Cyprus, it's applicable to strangers as well, which I like.
Yeah.
But on the, I don't want to say on the state level, but on the official structural level, like, you know, playgrounds in restaurants, I can't think off the top of my head any restaurants in Nicosia that have playgrounds included in the restaurant. There was one, I won't name it because I don't want to promote them. There was one, there was a little playground, it was okay, but all the smokers were sitting around the playground. Yeah. So it was rendered useless.
Yeah. And if they do have a playground, then the food is subpar.
I'll tolerate the subpar. And the other thing as well, being a super hot country, the playgrounds that do exist in some villages, for example, that are public square village, they're the park in the public square near a tavern, often are exposed, lack of trees, lack of shade, so they're not usable anywhere, you know. But look, let's go back to your writing. So now, you're explaining, you're sharing, you're writing up the human experience of parenting. How does your wife feel about you sharing this with the world?
So my wife, both me and my wife have PhDs, right? So mm-hmm. over the years, we wrote a lot of material, both for university, but also for public consumption through blogs, newspaper articles, and whatnot. So since we've been together, and that's 15 years ago, she read and commented on everything that I've written, and I did the same for her. So nothing goes out without her giving a stamp of approval.
Ah, so before you share it, she reads it first.
Yes, but that's standard practice with anything that I write or she writes.
Okay, okay.
That is important, let's say, or public.
So you basically get peer reviewed before it's released.
Yes.
So
She's not a kind reviewer.
I was going to ask, is she flexible with you? Because this is not technically academic, so does she let you get away with some crucial points, or does she, like, you know, if you mention her in a bad way, does she remove that?
No, she doesn't do that. But I don't name her because she has a very peculiar name, so everyone would know who she is. Not that it's difficult to find out, but unnecessary.
Yeah.
So I called her Sunshine. A bit ironic. But she's not editing those parts out.
Okay.
It's just because we discuss the things that I write, in cases where the way I wrote it does not reflect what we have discussed and what she knows are my thoughts, she helps me with that bit.
Okay. No.
The only one that she was a bit uncomfortable was the entry on religion.
Right.
Which was understandable because she's a Christian Orthodox. I'm a non-believer. I have been for many years. So inevitably there was a clash. But not, it's just, okay, this is your opinion. I don't agree with it, but it looks okay.
Now, I know I'm privy to I'm privy to some knowledge here. I know that you agreed with her to raise the children to be baptized, for example, correct?
She put me in a tricky situation.
She can't edit this podcast, by the way.
In the very, very early stages of our relationship, she told me, look, if we're going to stay together and eventually in some time in the future we have kids, I want to raise them in a Christian Orthodox tradition. This means going to church with me, getting baptized, the whole thing. Are you on board? I said yes.
Were you just love struck at the time?
I was love struck. I wanted to get into her pants, so you say yes to anything that's proposed there.
Yeah, we were honest.
And that's biting me in the ass to this day.
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, I think that everything in moderation. I mean, I don't know if you go every Sunday into every Thursday night or whatever. I don't even know when the services are. I'm ashamed of that. But I think that's okay. I mean, look, both me and my wife, we're not very religious. I mean, we're spiritual maybe, but we're not religious. But we did want to baptize the children. And in a way, it was almost a cultural event rather than a religious event, if that makes sense. I mean, I know people that are militant atheists that have baptized their kids. And I mean militant atheists, as in like they write blogs on atheism and they've baptized their kids. Because in Cyprus, it's just the kind of thing you do, you know. I like them, though, to have a little bit of exposure to religion. One, because they then have an empathy for those that are religious. They have an empathy to other religions, hopefully. And I guess not that I want my children to be part of the norm in the mainstream, but it is part of the culture where they're growing up.
Yes, you can separate religion and culture.
Yeah.
And having kids grow up in a setting that they are detached from the dominant culture, let's say.
Yeah.
Is a hindrance to their
development
and experience of the country.
And at the same time, by the way, the flip side of that, like being super religious, again, because you can't say that the people of Cyprus are super religious, as in going to church every Sunday, going to every single event, you know, saying grace before every meal. But the families that are super religious may also have this experience of being outside the norm.
Yeah.
On the other side of
course, there is certain conservatives that is part of the DNA of this experience, right?
Yes, yeah, yeah.
My wife is liberal
mm-hmm.
in all things that interest me.
Yeah.
So she's tolerant, she's liberal, mm-hmm. and I knew that beforehand, and I knew that we would instill these values
on your children.
On the kids.
Yeah.
So as long as they are either religious or participating in the religious events mm-hmm. through her,
yeah,
that's fine.
And it's through a lens of tolerance and moderation.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah, no, that's great, that's great. When do you think your kids will be old enough to read some of the things you write? When would you like them to see dad's writings? When they're teenagers, when they're full adults, after they're married?
No, I think when they're teenagers is fine.
Yeah.
Sometimes my audience
mm-hmm.
is them in 10, 15 years.
Yeah, okay.
For instance, when we decided to baptize the firstborn,
mm-hmm.
okay, yeah, I made my commitment, and to this day I stand by it, right?
Yeah.
But I wanted him to have my version of the story. And I owe him reasons for two things. I owe him reasons why I accepted to baptize him.
Mm-hmm.
And then I owe him an explanation of the beliefs I hold.
Mm-hmm.
And
he has a right to know this.
He has a right.
Yeah.
But I don't think I have a right to... Of course, I don't have a right to impose my views in this age, but I also don't... I feel I don't have a right to confuse him too much. So to...
It's a fine balance.
Yes.
It's a very fine balance. And I think that no one is ever old enough and mature enough not to be confused by this.
Yeah.
I mean, okay, not that you and your wife's realities are so different. It's not like, you know, one of you is a neo-Nazi murderer and the other one is like, you know, Mother Teresa. I mean, we're we're talking about a relatively normal situation here. So, but you're right, they do need to have a... It's only fair to have the experience to understand what their dad thinks and feels and what their mum thinks and feels. And as long as the most important part is that they see you two in cooperation with each other,
yeah.
in alignment.
Yeah.
And I think this is valid in so many things. Like, you know, maybe I like sports and maybe my wife does, and so the kids will see that I watch football. This is really not about me by now, by the way. Like, you know, they may see me watching football and they see mum watching the ballet. You know, like, it's an odd example to give, but I think kids need to see that their parents can like different things, and there's a thing called coexistence. And this moves forward in their life to not just their married life or their partners, or it comes into their social life, their professional life. They start realizing that I can live and work and be friends with other people that are different to me. If I'm to use an exact example, in Cyprus, I find that people that vote for a girl or vote for the sea cannot be friends. Or if they watch Omonia or they watch Abuel, they cannot be friends. In Australia, it's very common for somebody that barracks for Collingwood to have a best friend that barracks for the arch enemy in football, Carlton. And I have many friends. My brother supports Carlton. I support Collingwood. We are technically on the pitch arch enemies. But in the football stadium, we sit together
and enjoy the
and game. We enjoy the match. There's banter. We tease each other. But that's it. And it ends there. And in fact, the differences between us, we enjoy it because it gives us something to talk about and do. I think in Cyprus we're lacking this having multiple views of things, multiple perceptions, whether it's multiculturalism, whether it's different religions. We struggle to allow others into our circle and welcome them and be involved in them and integrate with them.
Yes, and in most cases, and this is where I try, I don't want to tell my oldest one, who is old enough at 6 to understand basic concepts, to tell him your dad is an atheist, right?
Yeah.
But what I really, really tried to convey to him is that some people are Christians, some are X, Y, Z,
mm-hmm.
because that's not something that we comprehended in his age growing up in the Cyprus of the 90s.
Yeah.
I became 13, 14 to realize that
there were others.
It's a choice, essentially. It's a choice, and that others socialize in a different religious and cultural environment, and therefore they hold different religious views, and that's fair game.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting you say that, because I grew up in Melbourne. I grew up in a very multicultural, religious, diverse, ethnically diverse country and city.
Yeah.
Okay. For me, it was nothing but normal having people of a different color or of a different religion or with an accent or not speaking English at all around me at all times. This was normal. I never batted an eyelid at it. So when I moved to Cyprus, to this day, I mean, nearly two decades later, I'm struggling with watching people have a perception of exclusion and dominance and their fear of the others, whatever that other might be. During the pandemic, my oldest at the time, she was four going on five, okay? And we put her into a kindergarten in Melbourne. And it was her first time seeing children of another color and children speaking English, because she was speaking Greek to that time. And I was wondering, what's this child's experience going to be like? How is she going to react to this? Within 3-4 days, her best friend was a girl from India. They looked very different to each other. And I remember asking her, tell me about your friend. And she talked about her personality traits. She said, oh, she's funny. She likes to play hide and seek with me.
She didn't notice a visual difference, right?
Nothing. And even to this day now, the school that she goes to, her class is predominantly Syrian, Bulgarian, Romanian, Pontian, and there's a few Greek Cypriots. And even herself, she's kind of like a Greek Cypriot of diaspora parents. I ask her all the time about the kids in the class, what they're like, and not once has she said to me, they're a different color, they're a different sex, they eat funny food. Her blindness to the other, in a way, it almost concerns me as well, because I want her to know that the kids are something different so she can tackle that and adapt it and understand it, because I don't want her to wake up tomorrow and all of a sudden, like, okay, to give an example, often she'll hear racist rhetoric in our friendship circles or in the general public. She'll hear racist rhetoric. She may not realize that that comment about anti-Muslim or migrant commentary, whatever, she may not realize that it's about her friends. In one way, I'm glad that she's been protected from it. In the other hand, I want her now, because she's now nearly 9 years old, I want her now to start defending her friends.
Yeah.
You know, when she hears someone say something bad about Muslims, turn around and go, what are you talking about? You know, my best friend is Muslim. Yeah. You're talking rubbish. So again, I'm at a turning point with her where I need her to adapt to the realities and mature a little bit faster than a normal kid would in another country to be able to start tackling this. You know?
Iris Marion Young, a political theorist, said that we wouldn't need group differentiated policies when differences like race, culture, etc., are as important as the color of one's eye.
Mm.
So the fact that she wouldn't identify the difference is very healthy, but totally I get the that now there is a next step to be made. The experience with my kid was, he went to a sort of hippie Montessori English speaking kindergarten, which was very diverse. So he grew up with this.
Mm-hmm.
And this year he enrolled in public preschool. So we pondered a lot whether we're sending him to a private primary school or not.
Mm-hmm.
We decided against it.
Mm-hmm.
And always I was aware of the fact that nation building starts from school, goes then to the army, and to a much lesser extent to the university as well.
Yeah.
And this year I experienced what nation building looks like.
In all its beauty.
Yes. Because suddenly my son came home.
Mm-hmm.
My son, who has aunties who are Turkish Cypriot, I work in a multicultural environment. Mm-hmm. I mingle with all sorts of people. And suddenly he came home with ingrained ideas of the bad Turk.
Yeah.
And of course, not even differentiated between Turkish and Turkish Cypriot, not that it would make sense to generalize for either. And I had to sort of try to counteract a bit the narrative that is propagated through school to say, look, your ex-auntie is Turkish-speaking Cypriot.
Yeah.
I'm going to a conference next week and my mate there is Turkish.
Yes. When he came and said these things to you and you started, you know, dialoguing with him, did he look puzzled? Was it a case of, why is my dad saying something different to my teachers? Was he pushing back at all? Or were you the superior source of all knowledge and information?
I try to avoid that, but he's quite smart and tries to find what is the limit of what can be said in front of different people.
Okay.
So he was trying to pick up what's going on here. But I find it very useful to say something and then pause, give him a bit of time to process, and then ask him if he has any questions or if he wants to express a thought. It was fairly straightforward. Yeah.
We're blessed with the teachers at the school that my daughter goes to, public school, are quite moderate. There is nation building, as you say, with, you know, songs and dance and cultural events. The school is quite multicultural because of the neighborhood we live in. So the teachers have adapted to that, okay? So we don't get the harsh rhetoric that you hear in some other suburban schools, for example. However, that being said, one day we were going to go over to the north. We were crossing the checkpoint in the family car. We're going to visit some Turkish Cypriot friends. And as we were crossing the checkpoint, she overheard me and my wife talking and about where we were going, and she made the comment, are we safe? And I went, what do you mean? She goes, what if we get attacked? And I just knew straight away that somewhere she's heard, if you go to the north, it's dangerous
there. And you need to not overreact there.
Yeah, and I have got to be, would I take you somewhere that I didn't feel safe? Would I take you to a house with people that weren't friends? You know, what's more believable? What you're experiencing right now? And I said, look, what you're experiencing right now? And then when we went to the house, I go, these people you're talking with now, are you having a nice time? Do you feel comfortable? What's more true? This real experience or the rhetoric you heard from somewhere else? I mean, I obviously didn't speak this complicated to her, but it was I'm summarizing now. And I remember she had this dilemma. Like, she was, well, that's what we've been told. And maybe not everybody's good. You know, I'm like, look, that's true. Not everyone is good anywhere in the world. Anywhere in the world. You don't trust anyone blindly. You know, that's the case. And I remember you could see the penny dropping. She was like, okay. And I've gone, listen, some things happened. And I gave her the story about my parents. I said, look, you know, she was living in a certain place. There was a war. There was bad people. And unfortunately, the few bad people made the lots of people suffer. I'm really trying to dumb it down for her.
Yeah.
And I've gone, obviously, Yaya, grandma, has some trauma and she's very sad about things, but she doesn't blame, and I use the names of the people that we visited, she doesn't blame XYZ. She knows that it was a certain group of people that did something bad. Who are they gone now? Or even if they're not gone, they are in this basket. You know, you don't have to worry about that. The world is not all pink rabbits and roses. I mean, there are some bad things happening. But, you know, and with that discussion, a few days later, she came home from school and she goes, Dad, you know, some of my friends from school, they're from Syria. And right now, as we speak, there's a war there. You know, and she was educating me on the war in Syria. Yeah. She's going, and that's why they left, because like they can't go home. And they were, look, what's happening in Syria is what happened here many years ago. The day will come where Syria will be safe and they'll be rebuilding. And it'll be like Cyprus where, you know, I didn't want to go into the whole Cyprus problem and where we're at. Obviously, she's only 9, 8. But I said, look, these friends will one day maybe go back to Syria. Then she got upset. She's like, so wait, I don't want this war to end. because then my friends will leave. And I said, and then I had to go into the whole migration story. Like, you know, yes. Some of these people, just like Yaya and Bapu in Australia, still live there. Some people don't go back. Even if things are nice, they don't go back because people change countries. Okay. And that was it. Yes. She accepted that, you know, like, so, yeah. But look, let's come back to your diary. Sorry, I mean, we're digressing and I'm taking over the conversation as I tend to do.
It's a conversation. It's not a monologue. I like it.
Tell me some of the other things that you have experienced. First of all, have you felt there's a difference between your oldest son and your youngest daughter? And I know I'm not going to get into the gender differences now, but like the kids themselves, the differences, is a different experience totally?
Yeah, it's...
Chalk and cheese?
Yeah, my youngest, my daughter, she's an anarchist. And the boy is this very...
Regimented.
Regimented, proper little gentleman. So it's very nice to experience the difference. And
you realize that they are two independent personalities.
Yes, yep. And you try to encourage the one to be more spontaneous and try things.
Yeah.
Then a bit to...
Whilst controlling the other.
Curtail the other a bit.
Well, I have this experience with my twins. Okay, they're not identical, so I can't blame DNA. I can't hide behind DNA or whatever. They're non-identical twins. One has a streak of apathy and independence and cool, calm and collected and whatever goes, goes. And I don't care.
Yeah.
The other one is super highly charged and emotional. Everything has to be organized and done in a certain way and can get upset and is quite needy. And these are the same. These are both my children. They're twins. They
growing up in the same time in the same house.
They're experiencing the same life experience. Yet they're totally different. So then I come along and say, well, the nature versus the nurture debate is, you know, kind of all over the place. Yes. Here. You know? And then the oldest as well is a different experience because the first 4 years of her life were so easy. I mean, when I say so easy, as in I hear the horror stories that others go through.
You felt like a super parent, I guess.
I almost felt like, you know, like we're so good at this. Like we're so efficient. I mean, like we were exhausted and tired, don't get me wrong. But looking back, those were the easy days. When the twins came along, I don't know what the polite word in English is to use. It was a cluster bomb of disaster, you know, like... And it's been nothing since. I mean, like, the twins are now five. So we've had 5 years of having three kids.
I have nothing but admiration for for parents with twins.
Neither do I, I should say. I mean, like, the experience is very different. It's very tiring. We've experienced seismic shifts in our friendship circles and in our social circles. Not all of them have been pleasant. Some of them have been marvelous. Our way of life has totally changed. We're privileged, I have to be honest, that we acknowledge that we're very privileged, that we can afford to have help, we can afford to have babysitting, we can afford to give ourselves micro breaks, which I know that not everyone can have. So we are blessed in that regards. We're blessed that, you know, we're economically comfortable, we're culturally and family, whatever, comfortable. So we're lucky in that sense. I can only imagine that even with all this blessing and privilege that we have, how exhausted and shattered we are. I can imagine people that don't have that help. And I can imagine single parents. I can imagine people with kids that have certain needs, you know, like,
yes.
I mean, the parenting experience can't be described. And I know that you're aware of this. I remember reading it. All these, you know, clips on Facebook and all these books that you can read, sometimes I'm looking at them going, have you ever raised a kid? You know, like,
I get the same reaction as well. I mean, I'm like, this is not realistic. The idealized portrayal of your life is to the detriment of new parents who are struggling irrespective of whether they have help.
Yeah.
Even more so obviously if they don't. Like, we have two pairs of grandparents who are loving, available, eager to help, and yet it was hard in the beginning.
Look,
now it's manageable, right? But this is a super privilege, which sometimes makes you feel that you are not allowed to feel certain things.
Yeah. I just want to pull extract that thought, because what you just said, by being privileged, sometimes you feel guilty for feeling tired or feeling like things are difficult or that you haven't slept, because you said you have got four grandparents. So you're blessed to have all four.
Yeah.
We're blessed to have all four alive, but two are in Australia. And here one works hours, doesn't overlap with the kids, and one is available. So I feel guilty at times saying I'm tired when we have a grandmother that can sometimes babysit, or we have hired help at times to do things. And I feel guilty that I shouldn't be tired because other people don't have that.
I think the feeling of guilt,
yeah,
is core part of the experience of parenthood.
Yeah.
There are so many opportunities to feel guilty.
Yeah.
Especially if you dare to think about your own needs.
Mm.
If these needs are not in sync with the needs of the kids. For instance, if you need a bit of personal time,
yeah,
to go to whatever, for some reflection time or to go to some exercise,
yeah,
which will make you more balanced and therefore a better parent.
And husband in your case.
And husband. Mm-hmm. That is associated, for me at least, it's associated with a lot of guilt.
You know what? I really want to dive into this because I think this is really important, because I like to believe I'm a feminist. I like to believe I support gender equality and whatever, but I sometimes feel that men do need to discuss men's needs. For fathers, I should say, fathers' needs. Like, I need a break. I need to defuse every now and then. I need personal time. Also, I want partner time with my wife.
Yeah.
Whether it's my personal time or partner time with my wife, I or we carry guilt. That guilt, it's natural, but it's not healthy. Because the child, our children, need us to be refreshed, need us to be happy, need us to be healthy and aware and ready for the next day. Because if we're not, then we're just shadows of ourselves and we're not full parents. I think we need to acknowledge this more. I think we need to acknowledge the fact that parents need to step away from parenting every now and then.
Parents do need that. Mm. I totally agree. What I also found out in this sort of train of thought was that parents, me and my wife, for instance, have different needs.
Yeah.
For instance, I'm an introvert that needs time alone with my book, with my notebook, whatever. I need,
yeah,
a bit of alone time. My wife has the opposite need. She needs to have some time without the kids for us to go out and meet friends and socialize. So realizing the different needs is also key. I don't think it's so much about men, women, by the
way. Yeah, no, I agree.
I think it's about what each one needs,
mm-hmm,
to feel balanced.
Yeah.
For otherwise, you are an emotional wreck.
Well, your mental health is, and in Cyprus, we don't talk about mental health anywhere near enough as much as we should. You need your mental health to work on it, but you also need to work on your relationship, your marriage or your partnership.
I don't think any relationship, when a new kid arrives, stays the same.
God, if it did, there's an issue.
Yes.
As in, like, the
but
kids are...
It can go either way. Mm-hmm. Either to deteriorate,
mm-hmm,
or to improve, or to have to struggle for a while.
I feel confident to say that few relationships would improve with having kids, because that would mean that it probably wasn't the best to begin with,
yes,
if it's improving with kids.
Mm. There is a closer bond, though.
Yeah, because you've got a common project.
Trying to survive the situation. And
but then there's also, I don't want to use the word hatred, but there's also tension that develops between the couple, because people have different parenting styles, different perceptions. The kids react differently to different parents. I can tell you now that the experience that I have with the children is very different to the experience my wife has. And we tend to kind of not hate each other. I can't find the right word right now, but we tend to like hate the fact that the relationship is different in different fields, different, you know,
yeah.
I'm not going to say overall, you know. relationships need to be worked on separate to the parenting experience, because once kids come along, it's a spanner in the works. It's not a spanner in the works. You've thrown an elephant into the engine.
Yeah.
You know, and when you have more than one kid, and then God forbid you're unlucky and you have, whether it's economic issues, health issues, you know, you become unemployed, or you're renting and you're getting landlords kicking you out. I mean, these are major issues in your life. These are traumatic moments.
Massive strain.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, relationships, I think people need to understand it is okay to get help. It is okay to seek psychologists, counselors, priests, parents, in-laws, neighbors, whatever.
Yeah.
You need to seek help, and you need to, more importantly, accept the help. Because I know a lot of people, they get offered help and refuse to accept it. I get people with the parents are saying, please, let me babysit so you guys can go out, and they won't. You know,
yeah.
You need to accept the help.
And I have friends like that. Like, yeah. Because the relationship with our parents also changed since we got kids. Suddenly, they are the grandparent, they are model grandparents.
Yeah.
And very different from the experience of being our parents,
yeah.
Which makes sense, because if you have, if everyone is healthy, right, and you know your kids can afford your grandkids and can offer them a stable, secure environment, then the pressure is off you, and you can enjoy spending time with them.
Do you enjoy grandparenting?
Grandparenting.
Just like the clips on Facebook and TikTok.
Yes, but for grandparents.
For grandparents. That's another podcast.
So we try to make as much use of them as it is polite, right? Mm-hmm. Not to overstep the boundaries. Also, many people do that.
Yeah.
But we do have friends that are reluctant to accept help from their parents, their in-laws, and they're exhausted. And if you're exhausted,
you can't function.
You are not the best version of yourself. You're nowhere near that.
Correct.
So, yeah.
No, these people, I don't understand it. I don't know, because I know I've got friends as well that are in this situation. They won't accept the help, and I don't understand it, because I'm like, it's for your own good. You know, like, and it's probably even good for the kid to be socialized with other people.
Yes.
You know, to meet and experience other realities and, you know,
ideas. I do believe that it really takes a village to raise one of those sayings that
it takes a village to raise a child. We, our generation, and I'm comfortably calling it our generation, doesn't understand the concept of the village, because the village has been ripped away from us. We are the first generation in human history, and when I say that, when I say we, I'm talking about the Northwest world, okay?
Yeah.
The economic affluent world is the first world in history to not have a village raising a child. Because if we go into the third world, we go into Africa, we go into Latin America, there is still the village raising a child. But in, like, you know, Europe, North America, Australia, Japan, there's no longer a village raising a child. What does that mean? It's not just about parents, grandparents, aunties and uncles. It's about the neighborhood, the town square, the schools, the cousins, the something that people get shocked hearing, wet nursing. You know, like having wet nursing is when one woman breastfeeds 2-3 kids because the women go out to work in the fields, for example, in the old days. Wet nursing, our grandparents experienced wet nursing. My grandparents have talked about who had breastfed them when they were kids. This is within living memory.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Today, it's such a foreign concept to be breastfeeding someone else's kid. But now, what's interesting is in the more liberal states, like I was in California last year, and there were wet nursing clubs that they were describing as the ultra-woke liberals were taking their kids to these wet nursing clubs, you know? And what it was is the modern world's way of, I'm not supplying enough milk, rather than giving bottled milk, I will go and find another woman that's breastfeeding, that's offering her milk. And I thought to myself, oh my God, like at first I was almost a bit shocked, like, oh, that's so uber woke and so liberal, and oh my God, how Californian. Then I thought to myself, That's just basically a structured, mechanical version of what we were doing in my living grandma's era.
Yeah.
You know, so I thought, are we doing a 180? Are we turning back to the old days? I don't think we're there yet. I think this still is in the realm of the, I don't want to use the word extremist, but I mean, people would call them extreme, you know. But the village, we need to bring that back. Now,
and having lost the village, we also lost skills.
Correct.
That were part of that experience.
Mm-hmm.
The example you mentioned of breastfeeding, right? Mm-hmm. In the generation of our grandparents, people were breastfeeding. There was expertise amongst the group to support one another in order to be able to breastfeed. Now we have the social pressure of breastfeeding.
Yes.
With very, very limited expertise on assisting new mothers there.
There's the expectation of breastfeeding, but there's no one adapting the needs of the mother to have lactation rooms in workplaces, to have time off to go home to lactate or to breastfeed, or to have babysitting services within the buildings. I don't think there's a single ministry in Cyprus that has a kindergarten or a childcare center.
Not that I'm aware.
No, but when you go throughout Scandinavia, in Germany, in Australia, even in Russia, I've seen it, where they have most ministries and big companies like the Big Four and things like that have childcare or temporary or the remote working that we have nowadays. You know, this is all part of the village. Like, you know, your employment as well, adapting to the needs, whether it's the mother breastfeeding or the father wanting to take some parental leave. I mean, in Sweden, the father gets, I think it's 9 months parental leave. Mm. I mean, in Australia, I got 2 weeks and I was lucky because it was twins. Otherwise, it would have been 1 week. I got a week for each kid. In Cyprus, I'm not sure now. I know that the rules have just changed recently.
They changed recently, but before that, it was very, very short.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I think it was a week or two in Cyprus.
I think it was
a
week. My job gives me a month, so that's why I don't know the specifics of the legislation in Cyprus.
Yeah.
But after a week, it's very harsh to separate from the kid and go to work. And also to leave someone who just gave birth alone to deal with the kid.
Because again, we don't have the village. The majority of us don't have 4 grandparents that can come over and help babysit, cook the meals, clean the house, go to work and make an income. You know, we don't have this. I mean, there's I'm going to speak now as the husband in my family, as the father. There was an expectation to immediately go back to work, immediately continue the long hours I was working, immediately continue being available 24/7.
Yes.
Text message, respond within 5 minutes. There was no understanding that Costa's world had rapidly changed overnight. And if Costa was not going to adapt in his private life and continue the work life to be exactly the same, well, then he should go look for another job.
Yeah.
You know, most professional countries now, those that are adapting, those that are, I want to say, more advanced, are starting to realize that it's good for the economy to help the parents. You know, helping, first of all, giving men parental leave helps the woman to either get back into her career and keep the career trajectory going. It helps, she's just given birth. I mean, there's no more exhausting experience. I mean, it's a major operation.
Yes.
I mean, you know, this is the only way we can move forward. And men need to speak up and start demanding parental leave, sick leave, flexibility to pick kids up.
I think that even in our generation, though, a lot of men conform to the stereotypes of previous generations, which is quite upsetting, but you see it everywhere.
Yeah.
Men who assume that role of...
And there's pressure on them. There's pressure from the village to be the man who goes to work and comes home late at night with a paycheck. And, you know, there is this societal expectation and tolerance of a man doing that. If the man was to stay home and the woman went to work, people would talk in Cyprus.
Yes.
It would be, he stayed home and she went to work. Well, that's odd. and they may even compliment him, like, oh, wow, you're such an amazing man for doing that. That, for me, is just called parenting and partnership and family structure. No. You know?
But there's also a lot of tolerance towards new fathers who are not at all involved in the growing up of their kids mm-hmm. and taking care of them.
What do you think, how do you tackle that? Like, why do you think there is this tolerance? Because that's just how it's been? Because I don't think it's been like that forever. I think this is more of a last 100 years tolerance. I'm sure, surely men were more involved in the past. I'm talking, when I say the past, I'm talking like going back 150, 200 years. Because, you know, I don't know.
I don't think so, but okay. I can't offer an authoritative.
Because I mean, like, it's hard to find any research from that long ago. Like, but because I just can't understand why would society tolerate that? Why would they tolerate a man that just sits back and does nothing while the woman does everything? You know,
especially now that you need 2 salaries for a household to function.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, look, I've got no problem if the father has this incredibly high paid job and they agree that the mother will stay home because, you know, his salary is so phenomenal and she wants to stay home with the kids and she agrees to that, then fine. That's their personal contract. Or the flip of that, if the woman, the mother's salary, like, again, I'm okay with that if the father stays home, you know. But the society, we tend to like to put, humans like patterns, okay? We look for patterns in the world. And I think humans try to find the easy pattern in family structures, in parenting structures. So they're like, okay, the pattern for so long has been man goes to work, woman stays home. You know, don't break that pattern, because that's the pattern I'm familiar with and that I like. And let's be honest, many men tend to find that very convenient for them.
It's very convenient for them, but also those parents, like myself, and I suppose you as well, where we try to have 50-50 sort of division of labor, which sometimes becomes 60-40, then 40-60, depending on circumstances.
Yeah.
If you are that father in Cyprus, you get pats on the back.
Yeah. It's like, congratulations on parenting.
Yes.
Congratulations on keeping your kid alive. Congratulations on bringing your wife a glass of water. Yes. Or the mother a glass of water. Like, I've actually said this in a previous podcast. When I first moved to Cyprus, to this day, I will never forget going to a dinner. When I finished, I stood up, I grabbed my plate, and I took it to the sink. And I remember all the women in the kitchen going, wow, bravo, Costa, wow. And I just remember they made such a song and dance about it. Never in my life had I ever considered picking up a plate and taking it to the sink, being over and above the role of a man in the structure. And I remember this big hoo-ha in the kitchen. And then when I went back to the table, the men were sitting there, and the looks I got... I mean, I can't remember the exact words now, but it was something along the lines
of... You're undermining their position. Yeah,
it's like, what are you doing? You're ruining everything. Like, you know, don't expose them to this, you know? Like, I remember being shocked, and I've been here nearly 20 years, and I'm still witnessing this. Same, you know, I must admit, I've become a little bit passive-aggressive with some of these micro-aggressions where I've said to many male friends, put your plate in the sink, dude. Wipe your feet. I'm just like, no, I'm not gonna sit back and let you be worshipped and treated like, you know, the all-being God. You know, like, where do you see your kids' future in the next 10-20 years in Cyprus? Do you think things are gonna get better? Do you think things are rocky? Are you feeling a little bit anxious about what's coming?
I don't want to be that pessimistic uncle that. Yeah. Complaints about everything. Things are not going very well right now, mm-hmm. and they have not been going well for a while. Mm-hmm. So if my kids tell me after their studies that I'm considering searching for a job elsewhere, then I wouldn't be happy, but I would be supportive, because as it stands, might be better for them. And I'm very sorry to say that, mm-hmm. but this is how I feel. My beliefs in relation to that also have to do with the political situation in Cyprus, right? Yeah. The Cyprus problem is at a stalemate, to say the least. Mm-hmm. And many of the social problems, not only the political, that we are facing in Cyprus, stem from that. And the longer the divide is such, mm-hmm. they will, we will be maintaining a problematic system that affects how the kids grow up.
I think also that we have to call a horse a horse. I think that a lot of our authorities, leaders, whatever, hide behind the Cyprus problem for everything.
It's very convenient.
Because planting trees, for example, has nothing to do with the division of the island, right? Yeah. Road safety, LGBT rights, you know, these things have nothing to do with the Cyprus problem. Yet, they throw ash in our eyes and they draw attention away from other issues, whether it's healthcare, education, infrastructure, the environment, immigration, cultural advancement, you know, all is hidden behind the Cyprus problem.
And democracy is undermined because the Cyprus problem, if not monopolizes, then takes up like 70-80% of the public dialogue.
It's a fact, and I remember Mr. Kasoulidis, the former foreign minister, when he ran for president, he released the statistics. At the time, 80% of parliament's time was spent on Cyprus-related issues, Cyprus problem-related issues. 80%. And he said that in his bid for presidency was that he was going to push the parliament to reduce it to 50, which is also a lot.
Yes.
Now, I agree, we need to solve the Cyprus problem. We need to reunify the island for everybody's. It's going to be a win-win for everybody. I wonder, though, post-reunification, what will they then hide behind? Will they hide behind immigration? Will they hide behind Islamization, globalization, the region? Because they will find something, because we cannot mature overnight.
I think that it's not a Cyprus-specific challenge, right?
Correct.
Sometimes we get a bit locked into the bubble that is Cyprus.
Yeah.
We have a rise in xenophobia.
Mm-hmm. Xenophobia, yeah.
Clearly. Measurably, actually. Mm-hmm. There are opinion polls that are repeated every couple of years and show that.
Mm-hmm.
It's within a more general context, though, which goes beyond Europe.
That's true.
Of course, they will find something else, have no doubt.
But
it will leave more space for deliberation, for public deliberation on key issues.
Yeah. Because they won't, they can't hide behind the Cyprus problem only. They will actually need to tackle some of these issues.
Especially if they integrate conflict resolution mechanisms at all levels of governance in the federal state, and that's key. Annan Plan didn't have this sort of conflict resolutions at lower levels, at technical levels, and everything had to escalate.
Yeah.
What they were discussing in the course of the 2017 negotiations was markedly different.
Yeah.
So if we don't have bicommunal disagreements that dominate the public space, and this is a way to avoid that, then inevitably you have space that needs to be filled.
Yeah.
And then you have other concerns that actually affect you because
the day-to-day.
Day-to-day, the Cyprus problem affects us, but not as much as inflation.
Not as much as the cost of living, not as much as climate change, not as much as... exactly. Look, George, we run out of time. I really enjoyed this conversation. I've always found your writing refreshing, and it's always resonated with me. It's been great to have a chinwag with you in person. I look forward to continuing this conversation another time as well. I want to see more of your writing. I'm enjoying it. I think maybe I should start actually writing back to you, because I tend to forget to actually write to you afterwards and say, I agreed with this, or this resonated with me, or I feel you, brother.
You know that this, just to say, I liked it or I didn't like this point.
Yeah.
It has great value.
Yeah, no, thank you.
Because sometimes you feel that you're writing to no one.
No, believe me, George, your Danu people are reading you, they're feeling you. I've shared you with many of my friends and family, and I will share on Facebook some more of your public stuff. Well, look, thank you again. Good luck with the next season of parenting. And yeah, my love to your family.
Thanks for having me. Thank you. It was great.
The first trilingual podcast station of Cyprus. Island Talks. Open. Diverse. Free.